Welcome to the Daily Wrap Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours.
April 1st, 2019. Thank you for joining me yet again. And I'm going to go ahead and put out a broad preface today to make sure you all know that nothing in this broadcast is meant to be a parody, a joke, or a misrepresentation. Because I'm not a big fan of those misrepresented news stories for the April Fools, which fly around every single time. But there's some important stuff to discuss today, so be sure that as much as it may seem like it to people that don't want to believe what we're actually showing you, nothing in this episode is going to be parody. We have the U.S. now officially on pause with its Syria withdrawal. Those that watch this show, I'm sure, are utterly shocked, and have now confirmed the 1,000 troops that we reported that was then denied, that is now being reported again, just like we kind of saw coming, that are going to be staying in Syria until they decide if this pause is ever going to end. The West Bank, of course, is soon to be annexed. The U.S. is soon to approve this, according to the Palestinian Authority president. And Israel, of course, is doing what it usually does in testing, you know, a new sound weapon on peaceful protesters and boasting about it. Fantastic stuff. But to begin today, a rather big admission, whether it was intended to be or not, from Guaido himself, when his own statements translated from Spanish into English, I think because they didn't think Americans were maybe going to see this because it was in Spanish, but that amount to him openly confessing that all of the current outages and things that are going on are because of U.S. sabotage, and it will not end until we can get Maduro out of the way. This coming from Global Research. I haven't actually referenced them in a while. An excellent outlet for those that have not seen it. Global Research is a compendium of fantastic information going back a very, very long time. Always does an excellent job. Entitled, Juan Guaido Confesses Being Behind the Sabotage of Venezuela's Electric System. Now, just to reiterate again before we get further, for those that have missed the countless times that I've pointed this out, as WikiLeaks pointed out that Grayzone covered, in a U.S.-funded Canvas group, that's the acronym for their name, that trained Guaido in 2010, wrote a memo that outlined exactly what's currently happening as the best way to effectively create regime change, naming the Guri Dam itself, which has been responsible for all the blackouts, outlining that that dam, to exploit that power outage or exploit the electrical system, was the best way to effectively create regime change and turn the people against their government. And it just so happens to be exactly what's happening. Check my older videos or go to grayzone.com if you want to know more about that story. We've covered it a bunch already. Now we have Guaido admitting what we already knew, what we should already know if you're paying attention at all. Now it says, quote, this is a confession from U.S. puppet Guaido pointing to evidence. According to journalist Gustavo Villapol, Wednesday during an interview, noting that the deputy of the National Assembly in contempt, Juan Guaido, because right now they've basically stripped him of office for 15 years, noting that the deputy of the National Assembly, that he's in contempt, has confessed to being behind the attacks perpetrated against the National Electric Service, the SEN, that have affected the Venezuelan people. The people, mind you, not the government, but affected the people on the ground since March 7th. As always, showing you the ridiculous nature of the lie that they're there to fight for the people as their every action is hurting the people on the ground. Now, this is translated directly from their own statements. Now, it says, Guaido has told the world that they are behind this devious and terrorist attack against the electric system. That he said this in the interview. And he said, here are the quotations from Guaido's statements at the National Assembly. The original link to this, to the original Spanish, is in the show notes. For those that may want to think that this might have been mistranslated. It says, quote, from Guaido himself, and I repeat, the cessation of darkness will definitely come with the cessation of usurpation. Again, always calling them a usurper, even though by the very definition of the word and their own definition of how everything's happened, Maduro is not a usurper. I don't think they even know what usurp actually means anymore. But clearly saying that the darkness will end when Maduro's reign ends. Very clearly outlining, and here's the next one. Guaido, quote, there will be no solution to the electrical problem. There will be no water to the houses, much less domestic gas. State very clearly that these things are being shut down until we can remove Maduro. And the last one, very clearly, quote, we will generate the necessary internal pressure to add up in this process of definitive cessation of the usurpation. This is Guaido heard saying this in a video broadcast from the floor of the Federal Legislative Palace. Now, the information is very clear. In addition to this, from the Canvas memo to the involvement of the U.S. with all of this, the connections to what they've done in past government regime changes, such as Chile or different places where they verifiably historically did exactly what we're looking at now, or the fact that people like Rubio tweeted about very specific information 3 minutes after it happened, before anyone on the ground even knew what was happening in Venezuela. All of this added together, and specifically the best one, worst and best, of Guaido's statements. He says, and I repeat, the cessation of darkness will definitely come with the cessation of the usurpation. The end of darkness will come with the end of Maduro. As if you really can't misunderstand what he's saying right there. So I really want people out there who are still on the side of the mainstream media and the government propaganda to really take a moment and think about all of the evidence that we can see, including Guaido's own statements that he probably didn't think was going to reach American ears, and take a moment and reflect on what it all means and the lack of evidence on the other side, the utter complete disregard for anything resembling evidence whatsoever. And all they say is, trust us, our intelligence shows these people are bad guys and they do bad things. So trust us when we want to murder their people on the ground in defense of democracy and freedom. And, you know, all the outages and all the problems and everything they're claiming is because of their actions. Now, there's a tweet that was shared in regard to the same topic by Anya Prompal from Gray Zone, from a lot of great places, of Elliot Abrams. In the same situation, because of all the things that are happening, acting, you know, like they usually do with their pompous attitudes. And it reads, Elliot Abrams gloats over U.S. ability to prevent Caracas from selling its oil and gold, says the goal of sanctions is to, quote, deny the regime money, and laughs while describing his gangster-like threats against creditors. Creditors being not the Venezuelan people, but anybody anywhere that wants to try to work with them, you know, give them loans to help them pull out of the problems the U.S. has created for them. And it says, quote, we have a wide, broad sanctions net, so be careful not to get caught. This is from Elliot Abrams, convicted war criminal, involved in all the same things, specifically involved and probably outlined how this outage and all of the things that Guaido is admitting to have gone. And now here he is gloating about controlling their funds and stopping and perpetuating the problems that we now know that they're responsible for. Let's watch some clips of this wonderful Elliot Abrams.
One of the main purposes is to deny the regime money that it does not use for the Venezuelan people. Some of it ends up in foreign banks, and much of it is used simply to keep the regime in power.
Now, that's just the first part. Now, what he said there, we'll go through a couple of these clips. What he said is astoundingly, verifiably false, right off the bat. All of the social programs, all of the free homes and free healthcare and free everything that they've been giving them down because of the sales of their oil, which is all verifiable. It's super easy to see this stuff. They just don't think you're going to look past their claims. The UN has acknowledged that it's very, very clear. Is there likely levels of corruption in the Venezuelan government that allow those in power to profit from these programs? I have no doubt. I just think that's obvious. Just as corruption is oozing out of every level of the U.S. political and corporate spheres. The U.S. oligarchy would have you believe that such corruption is limited to Maduro, which is laughable. Yet at the end of the day, Maduro, profiting or not, has provided far more support for the average citizens in Venezuela than the U.S. does for its poor. And this is so easy to document. So that is such an utterly ridiculous, laughable claim from Abrams. Oh, fantastic. I always love when these clips like to screw up on me. Give me 1 second. Let me play this for you because I want you to hear these clips.
So the first thing we did was we stopped paying them. You know, the largest source of cash had been the United States, buying about 500,000 barrels a day.
Yes. We know this part, Elliot, that you stopped paying Venezuela for its oil and just started stealing it instead, which many would say is the most important part of this illegal coup, taking the oil, all under a flimsy guise of fighting for democracy while actually destroying it, which is so perfectly in the way that they conduct their foreign policy. It aligns with everything they've done in the past. What many do not know is that the U.S. actually needs Venezuela's oil for more than just profit. And this is very interesting. Most of the oil produced in the United States is what they call light sweet crude. So the U.S. still has to rely on heavier crude blends, since most of American refineries are configured to process only heavy crude. So what this means is the U.S. must get heavy crude from places such as Saudi Arabia or, you know, locations with the largest oil reserve in the world of the exact type of heavy crude the U.S. desperately wants and needs in order to increase its energy geopolitical power. You guessed it, Venezuela. The U.S. needs control of the world's largest reserve of heavy crude oil because control over it will help it solidify U.S. energy dominance while once and for all taking the independent socialist state of Venezuela off the stage. Oh, and of course, its second largest reserves in the world of gold are just a bonus, I'm sure. But that's an important thing to think about in regard to why they want control of this oil, because it gives them more power geostrategically in regard to their energy. And they need that light sweet crude to effectively use the energy they're producing from the United States. I'm sure it's all just coincidence, though, don't you think? I'm sure.
We have had conversations with foreign oil traders, with foreign governments, really along the same lines. That is, you should be supporting interim President Guaido. You should not be supporting this regime. You should not be buying oil from this regime and giving them cash. And we've noted that we have a wide, broad net with our sanctions. And so we've warned people, be careful not to get caught in that net by activities that you may think don't come into it, but actually are caught by it.
And this is the best, worst one. You must support our puppet. You cannot buy Venezuela oil. Only we can steal it and use part of the profit to fund our illegal coup, basically is what he's saying there. And he says that they, quote, warn people to be careful that you may get caught in our illegal net of sanctions for dealing with an allied nation. I mean, first of all, remember that how is the U.S. able to hand down these universal mandates, these sanctions to other people? They're a nation like everybody else. They're not an international body. It's because of their control of the dollar. That the world reserve currency, everyone's forced to use their economic system, so they're able to. Without that, they don't have any legal justification to be handing down sanctions. They just have the economic power, the control, I should say, to do so. And knowing that those moves will hurt these people because they're forced to operate within the dollar system. It's illegal. So they're handing out illegal sanctions and saying, yeah, you know, if you happen to get caught in this massive net, it's your fault. Basically, that the U.S. is the law of the land today, even though they pretend to claim they don't want to be the policeman of the world. Well, they lay down the world law that everyone has to adhere to, and they'll go after any nation that does not abide by the U.S. mandate. He's making that ridiculously clear. And even if you do, you may just, you know, accidentally get caught in our broad net of suffering. And that would be your fault, of course, for not taking extra care to not violate our illegal U.S. rules. I mean, we really need to take a moment, and they've just taken it. The U.S. today, the U.S. oligarchy, their circle today is not even trying to pretend like they don't see themselves as the rulers of the world. When's the last time the United Nations has handed down something that the U.S. has abided by, or that the United Nations has been the body they've gone to effectively hand out sanctions? The U.S. does it on its own because it sees itself as the ruling power of the world. And that's not legal. But because they've got the economic and military power, they do it anyway. Once and again, clearly, do not feel they have to adhere to the very laws they throw down on anybody that opposes them. This is not okay, and it shouldn't be okay. Now, another example of the lies in the foreign policy, the ongoing manipulations, the utter political theater that's created in front of us to get us to feel like something's happening when it's never been the case, from Syria, this coming from South Front, something we've been saying repeatedly since this started. In another step back, the Pentagon to pause U.S. troops withdraw from Syria, according to a report. Who didn't see this coming? Oh, everybody that blindly listens to what Trump and the mainstream media have to say, because that's changed every 30 seconds for the last 2 months. That, oh, every day something shifts and changes. And guess what? Those of us in the beginning that said this all going to lead back to no withdrawal, increase of troops, the same foreign policy, regardless of the context in between, that's where we are. So it's important to think about that every time. With all the lies the mainstream media is getting caught in left and right today, I used to wonder why anybody still believes what they have to say, including the politicians. Lying is what they do. How many presidents can we look back on and see all the promises that didn't happen that ends up to a new candidate that promises things that don't happen over and over and over? Now, the Pentagon is planning to cut its combat force in northeast Syria in half, they claim, by early May. Or, they say, to about 1,000 troops. This is their own statement. And then once it reaches 1,000, to then pause the entire withdrawal process until further notice. Now, the New York Times reported this on March 29th, direct citing U.S. officials to the information. Now, last December, U.S. President Donald Trump ordered the complete withdrawal of his country's forces from Syria because, you know, ISIS was defeated. That was, I think, what, number three of the last 15 times they've been defeated over the last 3 months? Now, however, a backlash from the mainstream media, of course, because the mainstream media can't have us ending wars. That's just crazy. And senior officials within his administration basically forced him, which is important to think about, to make a U-turn and agree to keep, at the time it was 200 troops, then it became 400 troops, which is now 1,000 today, that are never leaving. And I doubt that is even going to happen. I don't think anyone's ever going to leave. This number has increased and staying at 1,000 as they're claiming. But all of this stuff, we need to think about the bigger story here in regard to Syria and how all of this stuff continues to stay the same as they pretend things are changing. Actions versus rhetoric. Over and over, we need to think about that. Now, I want to take a moment to share a clip with you from my show from March 19th, where I discuss how this increase, or rather lack of a decrease to 1,000 troops, was denied at the time. That this came out. This was happening. Oh, now with 1,000. And it made him look bad because they just said 400. And they, of course, said, no, that deny. That's not happening. That's all propaganda, fake news. And now we know that it's true. And I want to show you this clip of how I made a rather prophetic observation at the time. And it's not because I'm psychic. It's because I pay attention. And hopefully you guys are beginning to do the same and you can see the same thing for yourself. Top U.S. general denies plans to leave 1,000 troops in Syria. This is every single step of the way. From we're leaving Syria to 200 people to 400 people to now 1,000 people to every step it has been that it gets, somebody talks about it and it gets casually denied until it actually happens. So I truly think this is what's happening. Interesting, right? I mean, it's funny that, like, you know, again, I'm not psychic. I didn't know this was going to, it's because they do it every time. And people somewhere out there still say, take them at their word and say, oh, they must be telling us the truth. And now again, like, no, that's not true. And then it turns out to be true. Here we go. 1,000 troops are now staying, and there's a pause, which will be open-ended. Just think about that. Now, it's important, as I said a second ago, to think about how often Trump will say something and it will not happen. And it turns out that it goes exactly the way that Bolton and Pompeo and Netanyahu wanted to go. Think about that. How many times has this happened where they, in regard to North Korea, in regard to Syria, in regard to everything we're talking about, how continually he'll say something off the cuff and then it just won't happen and it goes the way that they said. Now, that there's plenty of explanations to why that may be the case. Maybe Trump found something out he didn't know. Sure, that's possible. Or it's possible that he's maybe really not the one calling the shots, even though he may think he is. And we may be an example of how he's just being cowed along. Who could ultimately know? Or maybe I'm completely wrong. But that is an obvious possibility that we have to consider as that continues to happen. It's important to think about. Now, reportedly, half of the forces in regard to Syria that remain will be, the 1,000 apparently, will be part of a multinational force, they claim, that would establish a safe zone in northeastern Syria. And the other half will be deployed in the area of Al-Tanf, you know, where they currently have the Al-Rukban internment concentration camp where 40,000 people are dying and being tortured and manipulated and raped and abused, verifiably so. That's the area we're talking about. So half of these troops are going to stay there in the southeastern part of the country to block a key highway linking the Iraq capital, Baghdad, with Damascus. You know, the land bridge everyone's so afraid of. But the point being that they're saying that half of these forces will be in one area. The rest of them are kind of just going to float around the country doing what we need. A multinational force that's going to be floating around doing... I mean, the point is, we're not leaving Syria. It's abundantly clear. 1,000 troops are staying, and they're going to be effectively, as they've said on record, fighting Iran and protecting Israel, because those are such clear national security interests of the American people. Or obviously not. And the reality is that this is not legal in any way, shape, or form, even under the U.S.'s own legal justification. The authorization for use of military force no longer applies to Iran or protecting Israel. Again, and they're doing it anyway. They don't care about the law. It has to become clear to people. Now, the U.S. decision to stay in Syria will likely escalate the tension in the country. Or you could argue that their decision to stay further in Syria is due to Syria and Russia trying to take back their own territory. So it's the U.S. essentially escalating due to them trying to take back what was rightfully theirs. Now, Turkey is already preparing for a possible military operation in northeastern Syria. While the Damascus government has warned U.S. proxies that it will recapture its territory by force if necessary, including the Golan Heights, mind you, which is still the case. And of course, the timing of this shift into the, you know, wholly unexpected, we're staying in Syria indefinitely, like we didn't see that coming, is perfectly aligned with the reinitiated Russian-Syrian offensive to retake what is rightfully Syrian land in Idlib. And like clockwork, the U.S. has taken a stance yet again, as you pointed out at the time, backing what even they have openly acknowledged is a terrorist-controlled area, a U.S.-backed terrorists-controlled area. Clearly, as we've seen them backed by the U.S. before, we can't deny that U.S.-backed aspect.
Look, Idlib province is the largest al-Qaeda safe haven since 9/11, tied directly to Ayman al-Zawahiri. This is a huge problem. It's been a problem for some time. Leaders of al-Qaeda that make their way to Idlib province often do not make their way out of there. But we have to ask a question, why and how is Ayman al-Zawahiri's deputy finding his way to Idlib province? Why is this happening? How are they getting there? They're not paratroopers. So, and the approach, I obviously will not talk about anything the U.S. government has done in certain parts of Syria on this problem, but the approach by some of our partners to send in tens of thousands of tons of weapons and looking the other way as these foreign fighters come into Syria may not have been the best approach.
Now, I've played that clip multiple times, and that was an older one, but McGurk himself has said that again in 2018, not too long ago. I mean, this is the reality on the ground. And the only people that try to deny this are those that are trying to propagandize the idea of what's going on there. It goes from being a terrorist-held area to being full of civilians only when they're trying to retake the area. Repeatedly. And this is something we have to point out. And this only happens now that they're taking it back. As Daniel McAdams points out, this makes no sense. Linking to a tweet where they are just threatening, warning Syria to de-escalate as it's fighting terrorist groups and fighting to take back its sovereign territory, the U.S. again stands up and says, no, 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 don't you dare attack those terrorists that we're supporting. He says it makes no sense. Just as Washington tells us, it must remain in Syria because ISIS can reemerge at any time. We just talked about that as well. The ridiculous, open-ended idea that we need forces because anything may happen at any time, right? They may come back sometime, ever, so we need troops in Syria. That's ridiculous. He says, but just as they say that they need to stay because of that, a U.S. diplomat demands that the Syrian government, which is most threatened by ISIS, de-escalate its military operations against ISIS and other terrorists. I mean, it's ridiculous that they have the nerve to do this, knowing that they've admitted themselves what's really going on the ground there, repeatedly. And of course, Partisan Girl comes in with a much more astute, this is what I take it as, breaking. The U.S. has just announced that it doesn't want al-Qaeda defeated in Syria's Idlib province. They want to stop the Syrian army from going after them, which is what we're talking about. She links to the same tweet. We're talking about them stepping in the way of them attacking terrorists. There is no possible benefit for the Syrian army to attack civilians, to just disregard international law, to use chemical weapons, all the ridiculous things they say. There's no benefit to them doing this. And their history makes very clear that they have not done that and have repeatedly made safe areas for the civilians to come back to. Just exactly why everyone in the al-Rukban camp, 95% as the United Nations just said, 95% by the United Nations' own assessment in the al-Rukban camp, 95% of them want to go back to government-controlled areas. How do you explain that? If Assad's this murdering madman that's gassing and attacking civilians, it does not add up. Unless he's this maniac warmonger that doesn't have 2 cents to rub together in his brain, which also does not add up with the history we've seen. They're lying to you, just like they're lying in Venezuela, just like they're lying in Yemen, just like they're lying in every other place we're talking about. because they're trying to control the narrative. And now there's defending terrorists yet again to fight off the army that has the right to take back its sovereign territory. It's abundantly clear. Now, in addition to that, in all the stuff we're talking about, here's where you need to remember the story I just covered from my last show, and its obvious correlation with the renewed action in Idlib. All of a sudden, and remember, Trump just gave the White Helmets $5 million more. Interesting timing, don't you think? All of a sudden, after they've started, and I've been warning about this since the moment that Syria and Russia began in actions again in Idlib. I knew this was coming because they've done it before. They need to maintain that presence there. And all of a sudden, now we have reports. And guess what? Russia has been right every single time they've gotten intel about a prepping of a false flag inside of Syria. They've been right every time, including the two that I can see that the Western media brought this completely ignored because it didn't align with their narrative, which was U.S.-backed forces attacking civilians and Syrian forces with chemical weapons. They just ignored it, both of them. But remember that this is underway right now, and the timing of the money to the White Helmets and the U.S. involvement, you cannot ignore the correlation to the actions in Idlib, and now the U.S. standing up and saying, again, don't do that. You better not attack these terrorists, or we are going to step in. So if and when something like this happens, remember where you saw it. Remember that you were warned. Now, in other news, in regard to the impending annexation of the West Bank, all of the foreign policy things we discussed, trust me, to some degree are interconnected behind the scenes. And I've gotten into those connections in the past. But that's why Israel's foreign policy and the U.S.'s part in Syria are directly tied to each other. But in regard to the annexation of the West Bank, which, of course, in and of itself ties to Trump's recent proclamation of the Golan Heights, which is in Syria, it all comes together. But in regard to the impending annexation of the West Bank that we all see coming, again, after Trump's proclamation, has obviously emboldened Netanyahu's disregard for the law. And we're seeing this everywhere. Here's a tweet from Jake Morfonios, which has revealed Trump's deal of the century in Palestine is exactly what we expected it to be, a royal screw job of the Palestinian people, which anyone paying attention has seen this coming. This has been nothing about this has been about helping the Palestinian people, as the Palestinian people themselves continue to point out. The deal of the century is the deal of Trump for Israel. That's what it's all about. He goes on to say, Trump is going to express support for Israel annexing more territory in the West Bank and splitting Gaza away, free Palestine, BDS. And of course, he links to this article, which says the exact same thing. According to Abbas, U.S. to allow Israel to annex parts of the West Bank and give Hamas Gaza. Now, this is, of course, the president of the Palestinian Authority, which doesn't mean that's necessarily the truth, but I think we do see this coming. Now, the Trump administration will allow, according to him, Israel to annex portions of the West Bank and split the Gaza Strip from the West Bank so that it can be a state of its own, according to Mohammed Abbas, who is the president of Palestinian Authority. Now, speaking at the Arab League summit in Tunisia, he says, quote, what is coming from the U.S. is more dangerous and serious, he said. Quote, the U.S. will tell Israel, annex part of the Palestinian lands and grant self-rule to what's left of the land and give the Gaza Strip a state so that Hamas can play there. Clearly insinuating that there's Hamas is a force behind the scenes being at least to some degree influenced by Israel and their desires on the ground. And he says, quote, the U.S. administration's decision is to destroy the peace, the Arab peace plan, and constitutes a dramatic change from the positions of previous administrations. Now, the Arab League on Sunday condemned the U.S. for its legal recognition of the Golan Heights for Israel, and again said it planned to seek a U.N. Security Council resolution against the move. Now, this included groups like Saudi Arabia. There is not a single country in the world that supports what Trump just did with the Golan Heights in regard to Israel, and they don't care, as I pointed out at the time. Trump signs his paper, Netanyahu holds it up in the air and waves it around. They don't care what anybody else thinks because they do not care about international law or what the rest of the world feels. Never has that been more clear than right now. Now, former U.S. ambassador to Israel, Martin Indyke, tweeted on Sunday, quote, so by recognizing Israel's annexation of the Golan, Trump is helping Netanyahu get reelected, which again is what we've been pointing out, which is 100% true. Which he says will then help the right wing annex the West Bank, which again, we've been seeing coming, which will lead to pressure from his base to recognize that too, which will doom his peace plan in Israel. Now, the UN General Assembly, the United Nations Security Council, and international law in general has held that the territory is illegally occupied after the Six-Day War when it was, I think it was 67, when it was taken by Israel in a war move, in a wartime, they took the territory. The United Nations Security Council passed Resolution 242 at the time that affirmed the, quote, inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war as it related to territory Israel captured in that war. And this has been the case for a long time. The ruling is by the United Nations that they have to return the land. Now, the resolution called for the withdrawal of the IDF, quote, from territories occupied in the recent conflict. Now, Israel has since withdrawn from Gaza and the Sinai Desert, annexed eastern Jerusalem and the Golan, and currently maintains military control over the West Bank right now. And even while the recent UN report shows with overwhelming clarity that the Israeli government has knowingly committed massive war crimes, and the international community broadly accepts this as reality, their actions on this front only continue to increase. All the stuff we're talking about, they're going to continue to push this forward, emboldened by Trump's actions. Now, speaking of maintaining military control, here's a perfect example of the things that the Western media fails to talk about and makes things like this up about U.S. adversaries. Israel introduces new crowd dispersal weapon against Palestinians. Now, you may see this and go, yeah, because, you know, crowd dispersal, that sounds nonviolent, but what we're talking about is peaceful protesters being dispersed in the first place, which is a problem. But it gets much worse than that, in my mind. The reality of what this is all about. Testing weapons is what comes to mind for me. We're talking about peaceful protesting being dispersed in the first place, and Israel testing out new weapons, and it draws to mind interesting things that we've been talking about in the U.S., such as even things like 5G and the reality of where that technology comes from, exactly things like this, military technology for crowd dispersal. So what are we actually seeing here? Now, Israel's occupation army has introduced a new crowd dispersal weapon, they're calling it, to be used specifically against Palestinian protesters, not violent protesters, not military actors, but simple protesters doing nothing wrong. But they don't care. They regularly use things against people that are simply protesting. Now, Israeli media reported this on Sunday. Now, according to Walla, the Israeli media, it is an audio weapon that makes loud bomb-like sounds. Now, reportedly, apparently non-lethal. The weapon was developed in Israel, though. Now, during the latest Israeli crackdown on Palestinian protesters, who are demanding their legitimate right of return to their land usurped by Israel, and in actual use of the right word, usurp, since 1948, the occupation troops killed during this time period 4 people. So it seems like these nonviolent, even though they have nonviolent sound bomb actions, clearly they're not working as they kill 4 people, or maybe they are working, 3 of whom were just 17 years old. They wounded 316 other people. Those wounded included 86 children, 29 women, 3 paramedics, and 7 journalists. And not a peep on the mainstream media, just in this short period of time we're talking about. And of course, while they're executing this new technology that is supposed to be nonviolent, where they kill 4 people, wound 316, 29 of them women, 3 paramedics, 7 journalists, 86 children. Clearly it's working for them. Now, since the start of the Great March of Return protest on March 30th of last year, Israel has killed around 280 protesters and wounded more than 30,000 people, 186 of which the UN report proves were unarmed protesters. That is a fact. And of course, don't forget the little ignored fact that Israel uses occupied Palestine as its weapons testing ground. So we can only wonder what this new sound weapon can really do. And possibly, already is doing.
You see, on top of being occupied, colonized territory, Palestine is Israel's personal laboratory for testing, refining, and showcasing methods and weapons of domination and control. Easy access to a captive and disenfranchised Palestinian population to experiment on has given rise to a booming homeland security industry in Israel that repackages occupation-style repression for use on marginalized populations in other parts of the world. It allows Israeli arms producers to market their products as battle-tested and combat-proven, coveted labels that give Israel a competitive competitive edge in the international arms trade. This has been especially lucrative for Israel in the post 9/11 era. Israeli arms sales have risen from $2 billion annually in 2002 to over $9 billion in 2017. The most extreme version of the laboratory dynamic is the Gaza Strip, which functions as an open-air testing ground for weapons of mass destruction. Gaza is home to nearly 2 million Palestinians, many of them refugees and the descendants of refugees who were forced out of their homes in 1948. Gaza is basically an open-air prison surrounded by an air, sea, and land blockade. This makes it a convenient laboratory for Israel's most destructive weapons. In the summer of 2014, Israel launched a brutal 51-day bombing campaign in Gaza that killed over 2,000 Palestinians, including more than 500 children. Less than a month after the massacre, Israel held its annual drone expo featuring many systems that had been used for the first time during the 2014 Gaza onslaught.
This was used with our systems. That video was taken by this system right here. So it works. Yeah. It's our system has been proven. We call it battlefield proven.
Now, somebody made an excellent point just now in the chat in regard to the same topic. Somebody said that Russia has tested a lot of weapons in Syria for the same purpose. But see, here's where the difference comes. Now, no one is trying to say that one or the other is right, wrong, or the other. I mean, I am, but in general, let's say that right now that nobody is saying that. The reality is that Russia is allowed to be in Syria. Russia is allowed to do what they're doing in Syria because the Syrian government is okay with it. They're an ally. They're allowing it. So good, bad, or otherwise, but they're testing. They're allowed to be there and doing it. What we're seeing in Israel is illegal. They're illegally occupying territory and bombing civilians that don't want them to be there. See the difference? And this is what we're talking about in regard to all the stuff going on today, where they try to make Iran to be the bad guy. They want Venezuela to be the bad guy. Well, they have all these claims when in reality, they're the ones that are illegally occupying all this territory. And you have to stand back from the politics of it all, right? They say that Russia and China and Venezuela, you want to allow them to exploit this country? No, nobody wants to allow them to do anything, but no one's talking about that. They're allies. They can go do what they want. The U.S. is what we're talking about. They're not allowed to do what they're doing, and that's bottom line. They're breaking the law. It's pretty simple. That's important to see. But sadly, talking about them testing this stuff on people, which is something they've been doing for a long time, even that's, it's still happening. Even with all of the recent attention, a lot of it actually, that Israeli war crimes have gotten, it really does only seem to be getting worse, what they're doing. It really does seem to be increasing. Here's a tweet from Rania as well, from In The Now. It says, Israeli snipers are shooting live fire at Palestinian protesters locked in the Gaza ghetto. How many will they kill today? This was yesterday. Or excuse me, the day before yesterday. And she tweets to a breaking news where it says clearly that people are being shot in these areas. It's something we need to begin to recognize, that this is happening on a regular basis. And because of Trump's recent proclamation, they're only emboldened. They're only acting with more impunity. And we need to see that. People are dying on a regular basis. And again, as I always say, imagine if even a fraction of this was happening in Venezuela today. Even a fraction of what's happening in France was happening in Syria or any of the countries they're trying to overthrow. Do you know what would happen if that was the case? And she links to it where it says, maybe you can't see it, it says breaking news, several injuries by the Israeli occupation forces fire against the protesters on the eastern border of the Gaza Strip. And she, of course, responds in her tweets, American media only care if protesters are mistreated in adversary countries, you know, like Iran, Syria, Russia, Venezuela, which is the point I was just making. She says Israel has methodically killed protesters in Gaza for a year, and much longer actually, and no one cares. It's normal, acceptable violence. There are even op-eds in major papers justifying it. I mean, really think about that. That there are op-eds in papers justifying the killing of innocent unarmed people. While the United Nations roundly condemns it, while the reports show that they're committing war crimes, there are people in the mainstream media who are literally taking to their papers and writing about why what they're doing is necessary. That should disgust you, especially while the mainstream media right now is completely falling apart because of their ridiculous efforts to lie to you for 2 years straight. More than that. I mean, they've been lying to you for about everything forever, but the reality is that right now it's becoming more clear than ever that they cannot be trusted. And it's important to think about. Now, to end today, a fantastic video on the same note here to finish out the show by In The Now, that literally destroys the mainstream media narrative on Israel with simple, verifiable, incontrovertible facts. Now, it's a little bit of a longer clip, but I'm going to end today, so stay tuned if you want to finish it for yourself. But there, and this, I think it's from a year ago or so, but it doesn't get old. The reality is what she says here is the reality versus the narrative they try to push over and over, and this woman utterly destroys a mainstream media commentator. So please enjoy the video, and as always, question everything. Thank you for the super chat. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.
Dozens have been killed in clashes along the border today. It's become the deadliest day of violence in the region since 2014. Israel has been criticized for its response. Can you explain why Palestinians are so outraged by the embassy move?
So let's just start by saying that there isn't a border with Israel. There is, Israel has never declared its border. So what you have are the armistice lines from 1949 that also constitute the 1967 lines. And so there is no border. Number two, there were no clashes between Palestinians and Israelis because there's a buffer zone. So Palestinians who are gathering in order to protest their dispossession and removal and they're demanding their right to return as refugees are basically not confronted by any Israeli civilians, not posing harm to any Israeli civilians, to any military installations, or to any Israeli soldiers. So there are no clashes. This was the lethal use of force against nonviolent protesters who did not pose a threat to Israel. Number three, this isn't just about the embassy move. Palestinians have been protesting for 70 years, demanding their right to return and their right to freedom. Since March 30th of this year, Palestinians have been gathering for the Great Return March, demanding that they have the right to return as refugees. It happens to coincide on the day that the U.S. is opening up its embassy in Jerusalem, and that is why there is a coincidence of these issues. But Palestinians are there every day protesting in silence or in marches with or without the spectacle of an embassy opening.
So you do not believe then that Hamas is inciting these protesters?
It has been made very clear that this is a gathering of Palestinian civil society who have organized themselves without any direction from Hamas and, in fact, in contravention to them. Hamas is not just Israel's nightmare. Palestinians don't want them either, but that is actually a scarecrow in this situation. When we continuously look at Hamas as the source of the issues, what we're doing is we are dehumanizing Palestinians who have been protesting for 70 years. Hamas wasn't created until 1987. Why were Palestinians protesting before then? Palestinians are being removed in Jerusalem, in Sheikh Jarrah, in Hizmet, within Israel, in Umm al-Hiran. There is no Hamas there. This is a scarecrow, and we should engage in more responsible discussion about why Palestinians are protesting, how their human rights are being violated, and how Israel needs to be held to account.
So obviously this goes back, as you said, 70 years. What is the significance of today's move of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem?
For Israel declared its independence on May 14, 1948. Palestinians consider May 15th, the day that their forced exile and removal was consecrated, as their catastrophe or their Nakba. Unlike any other country where refugees are given the right to return, Israel has prohibited the Palestinian refugees from the right to go back to their own homes because it explicitly does not want to disrupt a Jewish demographic majority. It wants to enshrine a racial, religious supremacy, and the mere presence of Palestinians would upend that. Now, already on the ground, there is a situation of de jure apartheid, but the return of refugees would make that more obvious because Israel does not want to absorb Palestinians into its citizenry because it would make it even more blatant and instead enshrines a policy of apartheid to exclude them from any benefits while it continues to regulate their lives.
Now, just to get back to the issue of Hamas for a moment, I know you say that many Palestinians reject Hamas as well, but it does control Gaza and is helping to organize some of the organizations, and it has declared its intention to destroy Israel. So does Palestinian leadership need to acknowledge the right for Israel to exist in order to achieve peace? Do you think peace will come through a two-state solution?
Do you know, I think your viewers should know, that Palestinians, the Palestinian National Council, recognized Israel's right to exist in 1988 and declared that Palestine will have an independent state in the West Bank and Gaza since 1988. They agreed to this again in 1993. This is an old situation. The only entity that does not want Israel's state within the 1967 borders is Israel itself, because it wants the entirety of the land between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea. It has obviated a sovereign Palestinian state. It is the source of dysfunction. Netanyahu has said numerous times there will never be a Palestinian state. When he says that, he's basically saying there's no two-state solution. It's really odd then that we go back and put the blame on Palestine for what Israel has torpedoed as the best way to ensure its exclusive sovereignty. And then about Hamas, it also merits mention that Hamas has recognized that it would enter into negotiations with Israel in a unity government, and that it also endorses a two-state solution. So unless we want to blatantly disregard the empirical evidence on file, we cannot pursue this line of reasoning.
What would you suggest then at this point, you know, Palestinians do going forward? In Jared Kushner's speech at the opening of the embassy, he said, and this is his opinion, Palestinians participating in the Gaza border protests are, quote, part of the problem and not part of the solution. What is your response? What should Palestinians do?
You know, I wonder, I ask myself the same thing. What should Palestinians do? How much more do they need to do to protest peacefully, to have barbecues at the border, to fly kites, to have circuses, to actually participate in flotillas that are breaking the blockade, to engage in boycott, divestment, and sanctions of Israel? We have tried almost everything, and everything that we do, we're being told that it's our fault that we can't be free. That's the problem. It's almost like telling Black Americans, you can't be free unless you just capitulate and stop protesting and stop demanding equality and stop demanding freedom, as if it was MLK's fault for crossing the bridge in Selma and not the fault of white supremacy that was subjugating a population unreasonably, cruelly, immorally. So my question is, what will it take for the international community to finally respond and say, how many poor Palestinians need to be killed? 6 children were killed today. 108 Palestinians have been killed since March 30th. How many more decades do they need to endure this subjugation before there is a shift in this unreasonable status quo?
And what would you recommend?
I would recommend freedom. I would recommend a world that is the exact opposite of what Trump and Netanyahu are driving us into, which is a series of garrison states of exclusive, explicit, racial, religious supremacy. I would engage in a world where we actually believe that all humans are created equal, where we're actually engaging in a universalist vision, where we, all of us, it's all of us or none of us,
but who
where
should,
there is room for everybody, and that's what Palestinians are demanding.
And who would
They're
you
only
say
demanding,
but who would you say is the leadership that should negotiate this? I mean, Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas has now said...
Negotiate what? The Palestinians have been negotiating for 25 years, and in every series of negotiations, what has been offered to them, if you study the text, what has been offered to them is a series of autonomous regions where they don't exercise sovereignty. They are being given the choice of how to decorate their prison cells. They are not being given the choice to be free. If Palestinians want to negotiate, they said in 1988, we recognize Israel. We just want a state alongside Israel. That wasn't in contest. The only impediment to that realization has been Israel itself. So why don't we start shifting the conversation and ask Israel why it doesn't want to negotiate with Palestinians, why it doesn't want to recognize their right to exist, why it wants to maintain a supremacist regime that provides racial benefits based on religion rather than on human existence.